Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, the Regulation 2 guest today. Jeff Charlotte will talk about his new book, The Undertow, a look at the forces driving us towards fascism, a word both Jeff and I have chosen with care. And then the historian Claire Dunning will talk about her book, Nonprofit Neighborhoods, an investigation of how philanthropists and the like have shaped urban governance over the last 6 decades. If you think Trump and his followers have gotten scarier with time, you are not alone. Jeff Charlotte is a journalist who's been covering religion in the right wing for 2 decades now. He's also a professor of writing at Dartmouth. Charlotte was the co-founder of 2 websites in religion, Killing the Buddha and The Revealer. The most famous of his 8 books is The Family from 2008, a study of a secretive association of high-end Christian evangelicals. He's now out with The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, published by Norton. It's a collection of essays on life in the Trump era. Jeff and I discuss his change of heart on using the word fascism. Like him, for years I thought the word was overdone, more an epithet than a tool of analysis. Either the world has changed or I have. Watching the spread of an eroticized violence in the right, the nihilism, the authoritarianism, that's all been increasingly scary. This is a challenge to the left. As we also discuss, the Trump crowd gets an enormous emotional satisfaction from the movement and its rhetoric. We just don't have that. We've lost the imaginative ambition we once had. We still haven't recovered from the prevailing notion of the 1980s and 90s that such ambitions always end in the gulag. We need to do better. You can't fight bullets with bullet points. Okay, here's Jeff Charlotte. This is a collection of essays written at various times, right? Could you describe the process of writing them and putting it together? What's in here?
So The Undertow began in sort of 2018. I've been writing about the right-wing movements for about 20 years, and I had these pieces that had sort of revolved around what a friend of mine, Jeffrey Ruoff, a filmmaker, calls the Trumpocene, the age of Trump. At first, I thought it was going to be just a collection of essays, and then really I think the book changed on January 6, 2021, and watching the insurrection and watching in particular the death of a young white woman named Ashley Babbitt, who became sort of a martyr of the movement. 2/3 of the book takes place after January 6, and so then displacing a lot of the essays, and it's a little bit as if The Undertow was dragged out itself by the acceleration of what I do see as a fascist movement.
What is The Undertow of the title?
Originally, The Undertow was, you know, there's some early chapters in the book, one about something called the men's rights movement, which is this idea that men, in fact, are the oppressed class of society. And these were guys who were using the term red-pilled, now popular all over the right, many years before it became the vernacular with which one describes the light bulb that goes off over your head and you discover that your white grievance is justified and that your hate is glorious and everything else. So they were always there and they were sort of picking up steam, and there's other kind of movements that I was looking at flow into this, right? I think of social movements and fascism as a social movement as not a singular a force, but a convergence of a lot of currents. The Undertow is sort of those currents that have been carrying us out to this moment for a long time. And then suddenly, especially a lot of mainstream media people sort of look around and say, what? How did we get here? The Undertow has been pulling us in this direction for years.
By strange coincidence, the book opens with an essay about Harry Belafonte, which almost serves as a memorial. You describe an amazing integrity and strength in the guy, and how that was really drained out by the white pop culture machine. The story you tell about that Revlon special is very interesting. Could you tell us that story?
Yeah, this is in 1959. It is, I think, the most radical hour of broadcast television I've ever seen, maybe the best hour of television I've ever seen. And when I first saw it, actually, you can only see it in one archive in New York. But the great news is it's now on YouTube, Tonight with Belafonte. And in 1959, he's one of the biggest stars in the country. Harry Belafonte was the first person in America to sell 1 million records. It wasn't Elvis. It was a black man, Belafonte, same year, 1956. And Revlon, the makeup company, says, Belfonte is a gorgeous man and he's so charming and, you know, do this special. So he takes that moment and he decides to start it with a chain gang song, Black Men in Chains, a very bitter, strong song. And he brings on Odetta, and Odetta at the time terrified Revlon. They wanted Lena Horne. They wanted someone very beautiful and so on. And Odetta is beautiful, but not, she's an angry gorgeous. And it was just all this liberation music for 1 hour, displacing Zane Grey Theater. And when I saw that in the archive and understood it as sort of like this signal from this country that could have been, and understood then too how popular culture sort of smooths down, sands off the sharp edges of some of our most brilliant artists, like Harry Belafonte, who always understood himself as a radical artist, a liberation artist, and yet comes down to us, the nice man who sings Deo itself, in his understanding and where he learned it from on the docks in Jamaica, a work song, a labor song, a let's get free song.
And he drove a hard bargain too, right? They offered him money and he wouldn't take their terms.
Yeah. It was a huge sum of money at the time. He was really one of the biggest stars in America. And they put this show on, and he insists on a young director down on his luck, Norman Jewison, who go on to be nominated for several Oscars. But at that time was just, he had recently been fired from Revlon. And that's sort of like where Harry liked people. He's like, people down on their luck, nothing left to lose. Let's go for broke. Let's bite the hand that feeds. And he did. They then come back and they say, okay, the shows are getting censored all over the South, and you can't have white folks and black folks dancing together. You can have either. You know, you're Harry Belafonte. You can have an all-black cast, or if you want an all-white cast behind you, that's okay, but you have to choose. And he said no, and he had negotiated this contract that meant they had to pay anyway. The check comes the next day, and he just says, and I mean, this is Mr. B, not stand it down as I'm sitting with him, and he's in his 80s and sitting in his apartment, and he's like, eat that, mother. That's where he was, and he understood that that's part of the struggle, right? The beginning of the book, I knew it was going to be a dark book. It's a dark ride, but I need to begin with some hope. But the hope couldn't be cheap grace, and it couldn't be sunny optimism. It had to be a guy like Mr. Belafonte, who was long in the struggle and who also understood that it is a struggle. This is not kumbaya. This is a fight.
You have an essay on Occupy that transitions into an essay on Trump and his movement. And it made me think that there are some parallels between these two moments, these two movements. And as you said at the beginning, fascism is a social movement. What about the commonalities between Occupy and the Trump movement?
I mean, I loved Occupy in 2011, and I wanted to include it in the book because, you know, I teach in a college. My students now, they don't know that that happened. They come of age in the Trumpocene. This is just how it is. These are the terms of debate. And I wanted to have that there for us all to remember that what I experienced as this really just joyous outburst, joyous and angry, like Mr. B, outburst of political imagination, and the very fact of it that then would become so critiqued, why didn't they have demands and so on. They were not trying to work within the system as it was. They were trying to imagine something that was not, something that had not yet been. So that was important there for the hope, but also the transition to the Trump chapter, Heavy with Gold, because the terrifying news for me is that I think a lot of the left has ceded political imagination to the right. Fascism is, to me, a kind of a dream politic, and I am fascinated by the way it sort of keeps spinning and producing these fantasies. Those of us on the left like to say, well, those are just fantasies, or even worse, just theater. There's no such thing as just theater. And there's no such thing as just fantasy. These are narratives that start to shape the world, and they are spinning them off at a very, very rapid rate. Dark fantasies, horrible theater, but we need to contend with that imagination. And we have pockets of imagination on the left, but we are not defined by the power of our imagination right now.
No, we fall into the programmatic mode too easily.
Yeah, that's right.
There is oddly a similar sense of solidarity, a sense of a movement, a sense that you're part of something separate from the normal that Occupy and the Trumpocene share.
Yeah. I'm actually really glad you say that. It's interesting. No one has sort of, in the chapter in Occupy, I write about a concept I borrow from Christian theology, right? This is a way of thinking about time. There's the everyday time, chronos, chronological time. Tuesday comes after Monday and so on. But then in the church, there's something called kairos time. And it's sort of like ritual time, time out of time. The ordinary flow of things has stopped. For the left, it can be a kind of movement time. And that's what that very first Trump chapter, I started going to Trump rallies to understand them. You know, I've always been writing about religion. What is the religious element of this? In 2015, I started going. Or no, was it 2016? Yeah, beginning of 2016 was the first rally I went to. And you experience that, this sort of ecstasy. You would be standing there for 6 hours waiting. The playlist is cycling. People are dancing. They are imagining with great pleasure the violence to come. And explicitly talking about what it feels like, the fist hitting a face. People who have never struck anyone in their lives are being liberated. It's a very, people are going to be horrified to hear this, it's a very sexualized, eroticized space as well. They're experiencing this in a liberating way, right? And yet it is the liberation of hate. It's the liberation of, let me give in to the ugliest bits of my id. Let me lean back into this undertow that has been pulling me out into the dark ocean.
And liberals and leftists just don't really get that.
They really don't. They really don't. And, you know, even now, sort of traveling around with the book, I get these questions like, how do we talk these people out of this? You don't. And you don't for a couple of reasons. First of all, look, I've been writing about evangelicals for a long time. I'm not an evangelical. I don't evangelize. I believe in building movements, but I don't believe in converting. And in fact, even evangelicals know that. They know that you can't convert somebody else. You can show them something they want, that they find attractive and they want to be a part of. So I can't go to someone who is feeling this experience and this joy and say, let me present to you a four-part logical argument for why your emotions aren't real. Every now and then, the other day I met a man who, a student at Union College where I was going to speak, and he said he had been assigned the book. For him, he did encounter some elements of Trumpism he wasn't aware of, and he was a Trump supporter, and he said it changed his mind. But then again, that's a guy in a political science class at a college. He's already there for an argument. Most people aren't there for the argument. They are there for the feelings. And that's the irony of that Trump slogan, "Fuck your feelings." They love their feelings, as they should. We should embrace feelings as part of politics, but not the end and limit of politics. And that's where they stop.
I'm speaking with Jeff Charlotte, author of The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, just out from Norton. The affective pattern behind a lot of this is this sense of loss, whether it's the loss of male privilege, white privilege, that these things feel like they're ebbing away to the people who are drawn to this movement. There's no easy way to counter that sense of loss or to fill whatever void it leaves behind.
No, I don't think so. And I think one of the interesting things that we have to contend with, there is no easy way. If we think of loss as a force, and we know from psychoanalysis and psychology and every other, you know, kind of science, that loss does shape people's politics. We have to contend also with the loss which is not legitimate, right? So white grievance is a loss of a certain kind of white privilege or the perceived loss of it. It should be lost. It doesn't mean that people without language to process that loss are not experiencing loss. If they lack that language, and if they lack also as those political structures that then come in and say, yeah, you lost this. You needed to lose this. This was not a good thing. It was poison for everybody, including you. And here is this larger thing that we are making together that is going to be more attractive, that is going to be more powerful, that is going to allow you to say, oh, it's time for me to let go of that thing. That's lacking right now. When I say it's lacking, I don't want to sort of dismiss all the incredible leftist work that's being done on the ground in small places all over the country, but it is not the great tide of liberalism.
No, it's certainly not. You talk about Trump as a prosperity preacher. And his descendants from the original prosperity preacher, Norman Vincent Peale. Peale had an enormous personal influence on Trump. And then how does he transmit that? What is the role of this prosperity gospel in powering his movement?
So Norman Vincent Peale had this mid-century bestseller called The Power of Positive Thinking. It's still around. It's still selling copies and so on. And his was a businessman's religion, a salesman religion. His whole idea was he took the prosperity gospel, which was this idea that God wants you to be rich. And how do you know? Because, look, God is making your pastor rich. And how is God making your pastor rich? You're giving your pastor your money. And that's how you're showing your faith that it's going to trickle down back to you. So this is like, we're talking televangelists, send me a love offering right now and so I can buy a new jet. And somehow that's good for you. Norman Vincent Peale, who Trump cites again and again, and I think this was one of the great failures of the political press, to not see that Trump was not without religion. It's not the religion they thought, right? But Trump is very clear that the three figures in his life, his father, Roy Cohn, and Norman Vincent Peale, that's what he is a combination of. That's what he himself says. And that's what he is aware in that sense. Norman Vincent Peale was this idea, it was almost a sort of an idea of prosperity gospel as a path to delusion, right? And we see Trump doing this again and again and again. If he says it, it is so. Fact-checking him makes no sense. You can't fact-check a myth. But he's then offering that to his people. So there's, in the beginning, what Trump is doing, and that chapter is called Heavy with Gold, because I was at rallies and they would imagine his plane, Trump Force One, they would love talking about all the gold fixtures on it. Heavy with gold was a phrase someone used. And they imagine, they look at his strength. They don't love him because he's like us. They love him because he's stronger than us. This is the love of a strong man. It is appealing something to the, you know, so-called common man idea, but also he's the Ubermensch. He's richer. His wives and girlfriends are more beautiful. This is the failure to understand. Will Stormy Daniels hurt Trump? No, Stormy Daniels will help Trump. Unless you in your heart are pure and have never experienced any lust for anyone who was not your lawfully wedded spouse, they're like, look, he wants it and he takes it. That's the attraction of the prosperity gospel. It's mutated since then. That was 2016. It goes through QAnon, a kind of a very darker conspiratorial gospel. And then I think after January 6th, we've been in an age of martyrs.
The role of belief in this movement is amazing. You quote a couple of guys talking, and the steel mills, they knew, were not really coming back. No politician could perform that resurrection, but at least Trump said he would. Didn't it feel good at least to believe? There's a whole lot of faith around this show.
Yeah, although those guys knew that Trump was lying. They knew that he couldn't bring back the steel mills, but at least he was telling the story. You know, and this gets us into the kind of well-worn discussion, right, of 2016 and Hillary Clinton kind of not really campaigning in Wisconsin and well-established critiques of the Democratic Party as becoming kind of a technocratic party that, you know, is telling folks, well, the answer is more education, which is not the answer for everybody. Not that Trump had an answer. He did not. He had a story. And that storytelling that he was then embodying, which was another element that I think was really a absolute failure. This is not just sort of like colorful details. That at Trump rallies, and even now we're seeing it again. I can't believe we're doing this again. A big part of Trump's performance is sketch comedy, is dramatic readings, is performances. I believe I was the first one to write about a bit called The Bullet, in which he would describe a fictional moment from history he claimed was real, and he would act it out, really perform it, of General Blackjack Pershing in the Philippines fighting Muslim rebels, captures 50, dips 50 bullets in pig's blood, shoots 49 dead, gives the last bullet to the last man and says, take this back to your people, and the crowd is screaming with joy and with ecstasy, and Trump is lifting them up. And I'm looking back at my colleagues in the press who have decided to stay in the press pen to become props for Trump's wrestling passion play. And they're looking at their phones because this isn't about policy. What does this mean? This is nothing. It's just theater. It's not just theater. It is the meat. It is the substance. Fascism is an aesthetic. One of the problems, I was talking to a New York Times reporter a little while ago who was really denying that we could use the word fascism. So I was curious what he understood fascism to be, and that was an area in which he had not done a whole lot of reading. Fascism, I think it's like Schindler's List, right? I mean, I'm paraphrasing. He didn't say that. there is this kind of ignorance, this ideological ignorance, that these movements are really powerfully aesthetic movements. And once you understand that, you understand that you have to follow those aesthetics if you're going to see the real violent impact, the economic impact, the political impact.
Well, your average cultural elitist is scandalized by the aesthetics of Trump, though. It's his own is gross excess. His followers dress very badly and have very bad taste. It's completely impossible to cross some kind of cultural boundary to understand the aesthetic that binds these folks together.
It's my own appreciation for cheesy appreciation for kitschen Americana as a reporter and writing about right-wing movements for 20 years and crisscrossing the country for 30 years. And I'm just always so fascinated by that great line from Joan Didion, so often misunderstood from the White Album, the stories we tell ourselves in order to live. And again, we have a sort of a liberal interpretation of this. It's just like, isn't that wonderful? And Joan Didion, what a glamorous woman, the stories we tell ourselves in order to live, the never-ending story. Well, you read the rest of the paragraph and you understand that Joan Didion, who was an astute political critic and thinker and reader of narratives, the stories are not all good stories. The stories are not all happy stories. The story Trump tells at another rally, and this was in 2020 in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and again, not reported at all, spoke for 20 minutes on decapitations, disembowelments, rape, so much rape, and then describes what he calls a bad hombre climbing into the window. A traveling salesman is awaiting. Like, a traveling salesman? What? What are you talking about? You understand that now he's drawing on sort of the pornography of his youth. Traveling salesman in his way, and his innocent blonde wife is sleeping, and a bad hombre is climbing in through the window. That's a story he's telling his people in order to live. And then he then says, now this is happening right now in Philadelphia. I know of a particular illegal alien, a rapist, who they have released into the Pennsylvania countryside. Now, are people sitting there in fear? No. They are ecstatic. This story is exciting. This is a horror movie. He is playing it for both a racist fear of rape, but also a rape fantasy. And again, the political press only says the next day on that rally that Trump had made a joke about staying for 12 years.
But Trumpism is a kind of club. There's a secret language, there are all these emotional bonds. Ron DeSantis certainly doesn't have that kind of magical power. How much can this movement survive without Trump?
I think completely, and I think it already has. What I ended up doing was, you know, as you know, following the martyr myth of Ashley Babbitt in the making across the country. In Omaha, Nebraska, at a church called Lord of Hosts, regionally prominent, small mega church, led by a guy named Pastor Hank Kuhneman, openly and explicitly and ecstatically pro-Civil War, recently hosted Trump actually on his program. He says, Trump is coming, he prophesies, he believes it's a prophecy. He says, Trump is coming back, if not the man himself, then his spirit in the flesh of another. That's why I speak of Trumpism as more than Trump. You know, I go back to 2016 and where I found myself, and I don't know where you would fall on this, Doug, but I was trying to convince fellow lefties, I was like, all right, it's time, Hillary versus Trump, vote for Hillary. And I've written very critically about Clintonism in the past, but I'm like, this is what we have to do, because it's not just Trump, it's a million little Trumps. Now, if I want to report on a Trump rally, well, I can go to that church in Omaha. It's a militia church. They've got their own militia. I can go to a militia church in California, as I do. I can go to my local school board meeting, where a wealthy group is now trying to challenge our school here in New Hampshire to I don't know, it's unclear, deliver lists of queer and trans students, which will include my own child. The Trump rally is taking place at your local school board, at your library. There are, in other words, a million little Trumps. And no, they don't all have the charisma, and no, they haven't all had the backstory with Stormy Daniels. And Ron DeSantis might not be it, and Josh Hawley might not be it, but they don't need to also. I think that's part of the undertow is, an undertow has momentum. You know, you're just like a little bit offshore, and now you're pulled out further away, and hey, this is going fast. Wait a minute, now I'm really being pulled out there.
Yeah, I got caught in one of those things once. It's terrible. You have a mea culpa footnote where you admit you are wrong in rejecting the fascist label for the Christian right and the family. What was that, 2007, 2008? And you've changed your mind on this. Why? What happened?
In 2008, I wrote this book called The Family about this sort of old, very influential Christian nationalist group that goes back to 1935 when they decided the New Deal was sort of a punishment from God. and they brought together this businessman's alliance. And to them, the top priority was breaking the power of organized labor, which, working with a number of congressmen, you know, you could really argue that they did, Taft, Hartley, and onwards. And after the war, this group was really interesting because they went and they actually recruited former Nazi war criminals, senior guys, guys so bad they couldn't come to the United States. So this group would charter planes to bring U.S. congressmen over to Germany to take counsel with these Nazis. And still, I said, this group wasn't fascism. It's bad. There's more than one kind of bad under the sun, but it lacked certain elements of fascism, in particular, the cult of personality, which is so central to fascism, which is transferable. I mean, that's what I mean by saying it, Trump's cult of personality is transferable to your local school board later. And then also the pleasure in violence. Violence has always been a part of the American right, but the open celebration and sensual pleasure of it. Those elements weren't there, and they weren't there in part because of American Christian fundamentalism. Unlike Europe, for instance, we had this really, really powerful fundamentalist movement. And you couldn't quite switch out God for a Führer. Jesus was central. The big move that Trump did when he came down that golden escalator in 2015, looking like the very strong man that groups like the family have supported overseas, bringing his fascist aesthetic, was, and this is a big claim, but I think looking at this, he edges Jesus aside. And now we have a cult of personality. There was this question. I had a question. Would the family, in fact, function as a bulwark against Trump? No, no. They slid over it. They embraced it. It's interesting. You go to churches now, you don't hear too much talk about Jesus. You hear a talk about God, and that's a theological switch. I was wrong when I said that American fundamentalism would always be an obstacle to that full fascism. I think we're here now. I think those who say, but this doesn't look like Germany in 1936 or Italy, they're making two fundamental mistakes. One, those are fascist regimes at peak power. We have a fascist movement. It is not yet a regime and certainly not at peak power. Two, fascism evolves. It may not look like Germany or Italy, or maybe it'll look like Spain in the 1970s, or maybe it'll look like Indonesia more or less now, or Brazil under Bolsonaro, or Turkey with its, who in some ways, so many ways, I look at this election now and we say Erdogan is the Trump of Turkey. No, Trump is the Erdogan of the U.S., these figures who set this mold. So fascism is evolving and so on, but there are these sort of core elements of cult of personality and so on. And I was wrong, and I think it's important to acknowledge that I was wrong. I think it's important for us to use the F word and to contend with it and not reassure ourselves that just because it doesn't look like the History Channel special on Hitler doesn't mean that we're safe.
That was Jeff Charlotte, author of The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, just out from Norton. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Son of Bald-Headed Woman, the opening song for the 1959 Harry Belafonte TV special that Jeff Charlotte described. Next, nonprofits. I've long held the less than popular view that philanthropy and nonprofit culture have had harmful political effects. They domesticate radical movements and are a strategy for maintaining ruling class power behind a mask of enlightenment. The tone of the whole enterprise was beautifully encapsulated in the opening sentence of Dwight MacDonald's 1955 book on one of the sector's leading powers. The Ford Foundation, which in 1953 moved its headquarters to New York City from an estate in Pasadena that was known to the staff as Itching Palms, is a large body of money completely surrounded by people who want some. That's the end of the quote from MacDonald. It's hard to find critical work in the sector because so many intellectuals want some of that money. Ford and his foundation comrades have played an enormous role in the transformation of urban governance over the last six decades. My next guest, Claire Dunning, published a book last year called Nonprofit Neighborhoods, An Urban History of Inequality in the American State, from the University of Chicago Press. It's a study of the role of foundations and nonprofit groups in administering poor urban neighborhoods. She's a historian and an assistant professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. Claire Dunning.
The process you write about gets its start pretty much in the early 60s, right, with Ed Logue and his concept of this nonprofit organization that came to be known as ABCD.
That's right, yeah. So one of the things that I try and do with this book is to think that the nonprofit sector has a history. It doesn't emerge out of nowhere, and the density and the roles that nonprofit organizations play today comes from somewhere. There's a historical narrative that can help us understand that. If we want to understand the role of nonprofit organizations in cities, one of the origin stories is urban renewal in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when urban renewal was gaining a reputation, rightfully so, as, quote, Negro removal. It was seen as an incredibly top-down process, and the federal government began to institute some pretty loose rules, but rules nonetheless that required local city municipal agencies, local renewal administrators, to seek community buy-in. And who constituted the community? There was a lot up in the air at that point. But in Boston, Ed Logue becomes a renewal czar in 1960-1961.
He had been working in New Haven, right, which was one of the centers of that old style of urban renewal.
That's right. Yeah. So he gets recruited to Boston by Mayor John Collins, who'd recently been elected in 1960. And he'd run on sort of both an anti-renewal platform, saying that planning with the people was going to be his mantra. He was a way trying to differentiate himself from earlier efforts at renewal in Boston in the 1950s that had famously cleared the entire West End neighborhood. And less famously, though equally aggressively, the New York Streets neighborhood, which doesn't even exist really as a place anymore. It's now the Soho neighborhood of Boston. And so John Collins says he's going to do something differently. He's going to, quote, plan with the people. And he brings in Ed Logue to help him do so. And Logue sort of recognizes that renewal is a political project as much as anything, and that to partner with local community groups could help him get some buy-in. So he imagines this renewal agency that would sort of parallel the Boston Redevelopment Authority, the BRA, as a sort of nonprofit corollary that would handle the social side of renewal. And it ends up being called Action for Boston Community Development, or ABCD, as this nonprofit, socially oriented, sort of human side. If the BRA was going to handle the bulldozing and the bricks and the streets and the planning, ABCD was going to deal with the poverty and displacement of these neighborhoods that they were targeting for renewal. And there's ways in which the incorporation of ABCD as both a sort of quasi-public, quasi-private nonprofit organization helped draw resources in, right? Being a nonprofit, you can pull on philanthropic resources in a different kind of way. The Ford Foundation gets really interested in what Logue and ABCD are doing. But it also gives the city a little bit of distance to sort of say they're going to handle these issues of poverty. And so that's one way where nonprofits are starting to play a key role in urban renewal.
Now, that's an interesting separation of functions, because you would think that shaping the physical environment would also have a lot to do with the social environment and vice versa. What's the concept between separating these functions?
Yeah, absolutely, right? And Logue, everyone sort of recognizes that the human and the physical, the human and the built side of renewal are intertwined. But Logue doesn't want to take full responsibility for the social side. He sort of separates those as saying, yes, these are simultaneously linked and important, but not my job. On the one hand, recognizing his own limitations. On the other hand, sort of punting on this really important side of improving areas that are traditionally underinvested in. There's a clear racial analysis to this, right, that places occupied by Black and other minoritized persons are less valuable. To make them more valuable, we have to clear the land and put it to sort of higher and better uses. But the one place where this goes differently is in the Washington Park neighborhood of Boston, which is a Black neighborhood of Roxbury, where there is a civil rights-oriented sort of settlement house called Freedom House, which had been funded by a couple, Otto and Muriel Snowden. they're social workers, black couple.
That started as really super grassroots, right? They met in their living room.
Absolutely, right? It takes a long time for them to even get an office to sort of set up Freedom House. And so by the early 1960s, they built a real community organization in Washington Park. And before urban renewal developed this really negative reputation, Otto and Muriel Snowden saw urban renewal as a real opportunity for Washington Park. Here were federal dollars on the table that they saw their neighborhood as being potentially able to benefit from. And they sort of challenge John Collins and Ed Loeb to say, work with us. And if you don't, right, we can only understand that as discrimination. Loeb sort of sends this telegram back saying, give me a chance. And Loeb extends a contract from the BRA, from the city agency, to the nonprofit Freedom House, sort of expecting Freedom House to manage the community participation angle of the urban renewal process. So Freedom House, this private nonprofit, starts taking public government dollars and inviting the neighborhood into their nonprofit space to look at maps, to think about what an improved Washington Park might look like. And they manage this really on behalf of the BRA. And it's a really productive process. They invite the community in. They talk about what they want their housing to look like, new schools, the street grid, both the physical and the social side of urban renewal. And they develop a affirmative vote. Freedom House facilitates a community vote, and it says yes to urban renewal. And it helps Ed Loeb and the BRA unlock federal funds. And so this becomes a really important success story. Otto and Muriel Snowden publish articles about it. Muriel Snowden appears in public often with the mayor and with Loeb to sort of talk about the citizen participation that Washington Park had undergone. And it gains a lot of prominence as this way of sort of partnering with a community group of moving renewal along. And so I frame this in the book as a very sort of hyper-local set of grants and contracts that respond to an immediate need in Washington Park, but set the stage as a strategy for governing and governing in particular Black neighborhoods that is simultaneously more inclusive and more privatized than other efforts at renewal or other efforts at urban governance more generally.
You quote Loeb as saying that this new form removed the process from politics and red tape and made the process more nimble. Now, this sounds very much like the kinds of thing Bill Clinton would say 30, 40 years later. But removing it from politics, that's a very ambiguous thing to do. Politics, where people work out things openly democratically in theory, and by removing them from politics, aren't you sort of de-democratizing the process to some degree?
Absolutely. It is this tension that really fascinates me about nonprofit organizations and the history that I tell here, right? So on the one hand, making a grant to a nonprofit organization at the local level is about creating flexibility, nimbleness outside of traditional bureaucratic channels, right? This is a time that is still familiar today where lower tiers of government are openly reinforcing segregation. Giving a grant to a nonprofit organization is a way to circumvent and move money outside of state and local governments that are denying access to Black and other minoritized communities. So Loeb recognizes this nimbleness. It's also a way of getting private philanthropic dollars to help subsidize processes in local neighborhoods that need it. That's all a good thing. But this notion of sort of taking it outside of politics, yikes, right? We're talking about power. We're talking about change. And that's fundamentally political. But one of the things that working with or through the nonprofit sector does is it creates this imprimatur of being non-political. And on the one hand, nonprofit organizations are by law prohibited from engaging in partisan activity. But what constitutes political? Ooh, that's a much more complicated arena. But we also know that nonprofits are deeply constrained both by law, but also by practice, by the need to keep winning funding from government and philanthropic funders. And so these funding mechanisms are deeply depoliticizing in the arena where we're also talking about social change. So Loeb keeps saying it's not about politics. Plenty of funders have and continue to talk about it's not about politics. But those on the ground, those mobilizing for a more just or equitable or equal future, know that this is, of course, political. Grants to nonprofit organizations are a way of validating or quieting political goals, are about appearing responsive with by delegating degrees of authority and taking smiling pictures and appearing responsive to civil rights organizing and demands without actually doing the transformative work that communities are expecting and deserving.
I'm speaking with Clara Dunning, author of Nonprofit Neighborhoods from the University of Chicago Press.
Entities like the Ford Foundation play a very large role in this process. What was the theory of poverty that they're working with? What caused poverty?
So the Ford Foundation and the Gray Areas Program in particular, those leading it were very close with the Kennedy and then Johnson administration. One of the things that I think stood out to me most, and others have written about this, is the coziness between philanthropy and government during this era and since, right? That there's a collaborative vision and sort of sense of co-investing often. So Ford launched their Gray Areas program on the understanding that society was fundamentally sound, but that opportunity needed to be extended to those who had been excluded from it. So this notion of expanding opportunity into the gray areas, of creating opportunities for housing or education or social services, that people just needed to be bettered without talking much about wages, political economy, capitalism, and the wider political relationships and economic relationships governing places. And so their theory was very much about extending opportunity and providing services to those who needed bettering. So ABCD in Boston and nonprofits around the country were seen as really critical partners and tools for the extension of those services.
The neighborhood problems, like we're talking about, social problems, poverty and everything that comes with it, these things are manifested at a neighborhood level for sure, but the neighborhood isn't really where these things are caused.
Absolutely. It's one of the things that, to me, is the sort of fundamental question we need to think about when we think about the role of the nonprofit sector. Absolutely, right? The problems that these organizations are charged and expected to address are structurally conditioned, created at the federal global level. Things of poverty, racial discrimination, those are not local issues, even if they have local manifestations. And the expectation that a local neighborhood organization is going to be able to remedy or take responsibility for addressing those is fallacious, right? There is a complete structural misalignment between the scale of the cause of the problem and the scale of the solutions that we're invested in. And on the one hand, nonprofit organizations were rightfully putting themselves forward as entities able to chip away at these issues. And of course, if you're competing for a grant, you're going to give the most exaggerated, boastful, confident version of yourself to win a slice of the pie, whether that's from the Ford Foundation or the federal government or another government program. You're then on the hook. Any failure to fundamentally undo economic inequality or racial inequality is then the responsibility of those on the ground when they are not the cause of the problem.
And also this model of distributing grants. You get the big foundations throwing money around that get filtered through lower level, more local foundations or nonprofits like ABCD. And then you have like various neighborhood organizations competing for it. It creates this situation where everyone is in competition with each other for what are very short-term grants. This perhaps is not the most favorable environment for solving the problem.
That's right. Grant making is fundamentally about power and about choice, right? It retains the power to distribute resources to those with funding, right? So whether that's in a foundation or in government, you get to run a competition. It's about retaining choice for the funder and not for those applying. So you get to pit organizations and places against each other. You get to sort of operate on a notion of austerity and scarcity, trimming budgets here and there. You get to enforce and discipline what programs you like or don't like. You get to demand reams and reams of paperwork and reporting, right? These kinds of grant-making relationships make places quite legible to those distant from them and quite burdensome when you're sort of filling out grant report after grant report, sometimes on a monthly basis. And on the one hand, we can understand that particularly when we're talking about public dollars, there's a way in which appropriate stewardship of public resources, that kind of monitoring and tracking is important. On the other hand, we can see how it deeply constrains and creates really vulnerable organizations, right? These grants are short-term, very short notice. These organizations are continually failing to meet payroll. They never get overhead expenditures to sort of build out an actual organization with the capacity to do the work that is promised. Strings attached to grant making can help enforce or sort of create a more equal playing field. Federal dollars in the 1960s came with a requirement, a string, if you will, that the board of directors include members of the community that they were meant to serve. So on the one hand, this helps amplify demands on the ground that nonprofit organizations populate their board of directors not with local elites, but with people who have lived experience of racism and poverty. On the other hand, these kinds of strings, again, sort of really deeply constrain organizations and their ability to function.
All right, let's get back for a moment to the institutional history here. With the Johnson administration, there came an enormous expansion in the amount of federal funding for these sorts of organizations and the model. What did that look like? What grew up? What did they do with the money? What happened?
The Johnson administration, under the War on Poverty, they created the Office of Economic Opportunity, which became a major grant-making agency. We tend not to think about the mechanisms by which it distributed dollars, but from everything from Head Start to housing to social services, they are deploying dollars first directly from the federal level to the grassroots, funding to run programs. On the one hand, it's this deeply radical sort of upending of who has knowledge and capacity to respond to local problems. It's a way of investing in civil rights organizing and groups that had long been demanding access to governance and to the ability to create change and meet needs in their neighborhood. This really diffuses money at the local level. Sometimes they go to directly neighborhood-based organizations, and sometimes the money flows to an entity in the city. In Boston, it's ABCD that then re-grants it and redistributes the money locally. These are often short-term programs, after-school programs, summer programs, reading enrichment, housing counseling, health programs. It runs the gamut of different social issues. Over time, mayors and then governors begin to claw their way instead of demanding access to some of these fundings. And so towards the end of the Johnson administration, money begins to flow through states and cities. And so then lower tiers of government began to have a greater stake and role in distributing money locally, which both continues to decentralize and build up the nonprofit sector as a site of service provision and goods distribution, but then also gives local political figures more control over who gets resources and, again, continues to infuse a political expectation or sort of set of priorities into these governing and grant-making relationships.
Okay, so after some dark times during the Reagan years, this model really came back to life under Bill Clinton. Some of the things you write about in the early part of it sound very much like a premonition of what Clinton was going to be talking about in the 90s. What were the modifications and innovations of the Clinton years?
The locus of where these decisions are being made are sort of moving up and down the federalist chain. And Bill Clinton, as you said, had his own version of it through the Empowerment Zone program and others, where he, again, is taking a spatial analysis of saying in urban neighborhoods, there are places that have been underinvested in. He's really big on entrepreneurship and business-oriented tools, tax credits and others to encourage corporations to locate themselves in inner cities, underinvested areas. Again, it's a competitive-based program, so we have cities like Boston competing against others from around the country. And in Boston, right, the application that goes forward doesn't actually get selected under the Clinton's Empowerment Zone program, but the processes that at least putting together the application had produced linger. And so those relationships and the sort of celebration of look how robust our nonprofit sector is a powerful political slogan, right? So Clinton's third way of politics between Reagan and Johnson, trying to sort of pivot between this liberal and conservative, right? It's deeply constructed and sort of a false narrative, but his third way is mimicking and drawing on this notion of the third sector of nonprofit organizations being between state and market, which again is a false construction. They are deeply intertwined with the state, as government grant making makes clear, and very much market actors, even if they're playing by a slightly different set of rules. But the notion of an independent third sector aligns with Clinton's third way politics. And so notions of self-empowerment, celebrations of diversity, depoliticizing some of these issues is really core to what he thinks is the right strategy. And so the celebration of nonprofit organizations, and we are empowering these grassroots groups, particularly those led by or working with people of color, looks good politically and really sort of continues to distract from and purposefully avoid a deeper conversation about exclusion and racism in this country.
You say towards the end of the book that these were not instruments of redistribution so much as selective uplift. And several times you make the point that, you know, they're not really challenging structures of wealth and power in any significant way. Here we are all these years later, over 60 years since Ed Logue wrote his application to the Ford Foundation, and poverty remains, residential segregation remains, many of the same urban problems remain. What was accomplished by all this?
In many ways, it's, for me, a sobering assessment and a hard thing to fully assess, right? And I don't want to be entirely negative on this, right? Nonprofit organizations. No. It's one of the things that I'm really grappling with, both as a writer and sort of talking about these findings, right? Nonprofit organizations do really important work. They have helped make urban governance more diverse, more decentralized, and more participatory. These are groups that are helping people stay alive. On the other hand, we can hope for something more than survival while also recognizing that that isn't even always guaranteed. And so urban governance looks really different. You can't have or implement a policy without the involvement of nonprofit organizations. That is a profound change in how, again, policy gets implemented and decisions get made. On the other hand, to your point, our deep problems still exist. And so how do we think about the importance and the inadequacy of these organizations and at a sort of higher level, this approach to solving problems? And that's really what I'm trying to do, not to demonize individual organizations or people who are working incredibly hard at the front lines to keep people sheltered, fed, healthy, safe, and alive. But to recognize that as a way of addressing deep-seated problems, there's a lot to be desired. And it's been politically convenient to sort of point to the grassroots and celebrate, oh, look how wonderful nonprofit organizations are, but then also expect more from them, cut funding from them, and to sort of shift the locus of responsibility away from the public sector and away from government. And that, to me, has been the biggest consequence of this approach to addressing public problems, that we look too heavily at the nonprofit sector to address issues that the government bears responsibility for, and not just to underwrite, but to invest in and build public capacity for.
I was Claire Dunning, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and author of Nonprofit Neighborhoods from the University of Chicago Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from that 1959 Harry Belafonte TV special, which you can find on YouTube. This Odetta singing Waterboy. Till next week, bye.
Well, if you don't come right here, come take